If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Tuesday, November the 13th, and welcome to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen, the Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Fellow in Journalism here at the Hoover Institution. My guest today here on the campus of Stanford University is John Yu. John Yu is a visiting fellow at the Hoover Institution, professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley School, and is a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. From 2001 to 2003, he served as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Legal Counsel in the Justice Department of President George W. Bush. Professor Yu is the author of a number of books, most recently Crisis of Command, A History of Executive Power from George Washington to George W. Bush. John, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Oh, thanks, Bill. Thanks for having me.
It is a big game approaching on the Cal campus. It is big week. The Cal and Stanford are engaged in all kinds of hostilities, and you are literally a walking house divided. You have Stanford and Cal credentials. So what is your plan for a big day on a Saturday at Berkeley? Are you going to be in town, or are you going to vacate?
To get as far away as possible to a calmer place like Washington, D.C.
So what would you do if you went to a Cal-Stanford game, John? Would you do what the president does at Army-Navy and sit on both sides? Or?
I have to say I feel bad coming over and spending more time at Stanford because I have so many fans in the People's Republic of Berkeley that I can't spend all quality time with now.
That's good. Well, welcome to Hoover, and I'm glad you're enjoying your time here on the Stanford campus. So let's talk today about a fellow named Matthew Whitaker, who is sort of the latest eye in the storm of a lot of storms of the Trump presidency. It took them not days but hours after the election to wade into controversy, and that was the forced resignation of Attorney General Jeff Sessions. And now Matthew Whitaker filling his job. Let me read to you Article 2 from the Constitution, John, and listeners, bear with us. This is written in Founding Fathers speak, but here's what Article 2 says about the appointment of, quote, officers of the United States. It says the president, quote, shall nominate and by and with the advice and consent of the Senate, let's emphasize that, the advice and consent of the Senate, shall appoint ambassadors, other public ministers and consuls, judges of the Supreme Court, and all other officers of the United States. The Appointments Clause further allows that, quote, the Congress may by law vest the appointment of such inferior officers as they think proper in the President alone, in the courts of law, or in the heads of departments. John, you study the Constitution for a living. Is Matthew Whitaker a constitutionally legal appointment?
Not as Attorney General. He could hold any number of other jobs, but not Attorney General. And I think the reason why is you look at that text, and it's actually pretty clear. It says there's only two kinds of officers in the United States. And by the way, here I'm reading, I have to confess, I'm using my Constitution that I downloaded into my iPhone. So I'm not actually sure whether the Chinese have rewritten different parts of this for us, but I have taken to carrying it around on my iPhone now instead of a little booklet. So there are only two kinds of officers. There's officers in the United States who are like Supreme Court justices, cabinet members, so on. The Supreme Court has called those now principal officers.
Principals.
And they have to receive advice and consent of the Senate. Mm-hmm. And then, as you read out, there's a second kind of officer called inferior officers.
Right.
And if Congress wants to vest their appointment in a president or somebody else alone, you know, department head alone, Congress can do that. But what the text seems to make clear, and the Supreme Court has agreed, is that Congress cannot move an officer out of the principal box and put it into the inferior category box, inferior officer box. And so it seems to me, what other kind of official would be a principal officer other than the Attorney General?
Right.
The Attorney General has been with us since 1789. It's not a new kind of job. It's the Justice Department is considered one of the four great departments along with Treasury, the good old days, war, and state. And the Attorney General is in charge of all law enforcement and all federal law enforcement in the country. It's hard to, if he's not a principal officer, who is a principal officer? So unfortunately, Whitaker never underwent advice and consent in his job as chief of staff. Mm-hmm. And so even though his appointment might be okay under a statute, I don't think it just meets the plain text of the Appointments Clause.
Okay, so you don't think it meets constitutional or passes constitutional muster, but
no.
Let me put it this way. The president puts the man in that job. How do you then take the man out of the job? Would the Senate have to impeach him? Would there have to be peer pressure to force his resignation? Mm-hmm. Would you have to file a lawsuit that would then take time to go to the Supreme Court? How do you resolve this?
This is the unfortunate thing is, and I'm glad you asked this, Bill, because a lot of people are sort of ignoring this question. It's like, sort of assume, oh, he's got the job, and they're all asking about Mueller and
right.
whether Whitaker is conflicted out in some way. But you asked an excellent question is, suppose someone's in a job and he's or she's unconstitutionally appointed. Mm-hmm. What happens? This is the bad thing. Everything that officer does is then presumptively invalid. And
right.
anyone who's affected by that decision can refuse to follow it and say, I don't have to because the person who's ordering me to do that is unconstitutional. So put aside Mueller for this second. And every single person prosecuted by the Justice Department during this time Whitaker is Attorney General could legitimately say, I should go free. You can't investigate me. Every FBI agent who takes every interview, the witness can say, I don't have to cooperate because the head of your agency is
right.
unconstitutional. So the unfortunate thing about Whitaker's appointment is creating this twilight zone where no one knows what's legal or not legal in terms of federal law enforcement during the period that Whitaker is acting attorney general. And I think of it as unforced error because the appointments clause that you read says that if someone undergoes advice and consent by the Senate, they could serve as attorney general. And there's a lot of officials mm-hmm. in the Justice Department who undergo advice and consent, not just Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general, or the solicitor general, or assistant attorney generals. There are 93 what we call U.S. attorneys who are the top federal prosecutor in every major city in the country. All of them go through Senate advice and consent. Any of them could be the acting attorney general.
Right. That does beg the question, why was Rod Rosenstein not given this job, the number two man in the in the Justice Department?
Yeah, that would be the natural thing, and that's usually what happens when the attorney general mm-hmm. resigns. That's, in a way, why you have a deputy attorney general, like why you have a vice president. He
right.
or she's there to fill in when the attorney general can't do their job, or with Rod Rosenstein's oversight of the Mueller investigation, when the attorney general has to recuse himself,
right.
is conflicted out. So I think what happened is that the Trump White House was trying to be too clever by half.
Mm-hmm.
They thought, well, they don't want to put Rosenstein in as attorney general because the president has been repeatedly criticizing Rosenstein's management of the Mueller
right.
investigation, or what they would say lack thereof of supervision of Mueller. So what they tried to do is they tried to pick somebody like Whitaker, who has publicly, before he joined the Justice Department, criticized the Mueller investigation, said
mm-hmm.
it's been going too far, said that some of the searches carried out by Mueller's team have been oppressive or intimidating, but not actually ever talked to him about it. So they could say, we never actually talked to him
right.
about the Mueller investigation, and put him in charge so that you have a friendly ally if your goal was to try to start restricting what Mueller was doing now that Sessions has left and the midterm elections are over.
John, if Rod Rosenstein is not fit to be the Attorney General of the United States in the eyes of the White House, then why is he serving in the Justice Department as a number two? Because in theory, if you cannot be the Attorney General, why should you be serving me as the Deputy Attorney General?
I agree. I think if this is what Trump wanted to do, is to restrict the Mueller investigation.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of other ways you could do it. You could fire Rod Rosenstein and
right.
replace him with someone else. You could put a different person than Whitaker in as Attorney General. There are plenty of people, including myself, who think that the Mueller investigation is starting to get a little bit far afield. This is not an extreme position or a position held only by sort of Trump partisans. There are a lot of people in the Justice Department, not just political appointees, but civil servants who don't like independent counsels. I think maybe people think they are kind of cancer on the Justice Department and the idea of federal prosecution. But if you're going to have them, you can put someone in charge who's going to allow it to go forward, but in a responsible, sort of careful way. So that's why I think sometimes my impression, Bill, you've done more of this, looking at the Trump White House and lots of other areas. Sometimes sort of political rashness, this sort of gets in the way of sound judgment where they could
right.
achieve their policy goal if they just took a little bit more time to think about it.
Well, I think there are a lot of things going on behind the scenes with the Trump White House. You know, there's stories out today that John Kelly may be leaving.
Yes.
Kirstjen Nielsen, the Homeland Secretary, her time may be coming up. Other cabinet secretaries on the move. So there's just a lot of tumult, I think, going on inside. Dianne Feinstein, the newly reelected senator of California. Dianne Feinstein, John, she said today that she wants to hold hearings on the Mueller investigation, not as to what he's investigating, but as to whether or not the investigation will be preserved. Mm-hmm. Does she have a legitimate point, or is she just trying to score points?
I think she's just trying to score points.
Keep in mind, while she's doing this, also the DA in San Francisco is interested in what's going on in the Justice Department, the Attorney General of Maryland. This is where Rosenstein used to work, by the way, in Maryland.
Yes.
He's getting involved. So, you know, what is the old Jimmy Durante line? Everyone wants to get in on the act.
Well, I never thought of Dianne Feinstein as the Jimmy Durante of our day, but it's an interesting parallel.
Yes.
Yeah. No, I think it's hard to think that the Democrats have a legitimate gripe right now that the Mueller investigation has been interfered with by the White House or Justice Department leadership. So, you know, Senator Feinstein could have those hearings, but as far as I can tell, Mueller has had a long leash, if any leash at all, on how to conduct his investigation.
And it's been about 18 months now. About May of 2017 is when it started, right?
Yeah, it's been well over a year. He has got a large budget, and he has prosecuted and successfully convicted quite a number of people. Mm-hmm. And according to the rumors, he's now in the process of writing his final report. And the last major issue, but this is, the big elephant in the room is the last major issue is he has to see if he can persuade the president to sit down for an interview. Because if you're trying to investigate whether the Trump campaign conspired, not colluded, which is not a crime, conspired with the Russians, you would obviously want to know what Trump heard and saw.
Okay, you're a White House counselor. That's another subplot to the story, by the way. The White House legal staff is not staffed up right now. They need lawyers. It's a good time to be a lawyer in D.C., be it investigating for Democrats or having a legal up in the executive branch. It's a good time to be in that business. But let's say, John, that you're working in the White House and you're a counselor to the president. What's your advice for him as to whether or not to testify?
You're giving me PTSD. I want to remember that again. But my advice would be, Mr. President, before you fire me, listen to me for 5 minutes, would be let the Mueller investigation come to its completion. If you ever want to prove to the American people that you didn't conspire with Russia, that the 2016 elections weren't tainted, the best person who could clear you would be Mueller. The Democrats and his critics have the Democrats and Trump's critics have placed all their eggs in the Mueller basket. Mm-hmm. And if Mueller comes back and says, I don't find evidence, and it doesn't seem like he's found any yet, that President Trump or any of his top aides actually conspired with the Russians to violate campaign finance laws or sort of electronic privacy and data retention laws, then he's going to be clear. It'll be all over, and he'll put it behind him. I actually think what Trump should do is do everything he can to help the investigation come to a speedy conclusion rather than fighting with Mueller, digging his heels, trying to make clever suggestions about handing out pardons and ordering people like Whitaker not to continue the prosecution. I think that's all a terrible mistake.
But John, don't you think that even if Mueller comes out with a report that doesn't nail the president to a cross, don't you think that investigators on the Hill will just go through that report and they'll parse it and they'll just look for a reason to hold hearings so Adam Schiff and Eric Swalwell and others can have their day and bring people up and still continue this narrative?
Yeah. Actually, this is the interesting thing. The big question is, as Ken Starr did, is Mueller going to find probable cause that Trump actually did violate the law and make a referral to Congress? The Justice Department doesn't think that Mueller can actually indict a sitting president. So the only thing he could do if Mueller thinks that Trump did something illegal would be to refer it to Congress, which would have to carry out impeachment proceedings.
Right.
I was on the Hill back in the day when the Republicans tried to impeach Clinton. I actually politically, and maybe I would say this to Trump too, not as a lawyer, but switching over to quasi-political, quasi-legal advices, if you want to get reelected, maybe the best thing to happen to you would be if the House started impeachment proceedings and did all the things that you talked about, Bill.
Right.
Yes, Adam Schiff and Dianne Feinstein, let them run wild with their impeachment investigations. I think that, based on what happened in 96, I think that would actually help Trump get reelected.
Right. One of the controversies with Matthew Whitaker is a comment he made in 2016. He wrote in an article, he said, quote, Mueller has come up to a red line in the Russia 2016 election meddling investigation that he is dangerously close to crossing. So, John, what is a red line in this investigation? Is this his taxes? Is this his personal life? What is going too far? So I view this investigation kind of like a Roomba vacuum. You just put it on the floor and it just goes around looking for dirt.
That's a good one.
And at some point, it's got to come back to the home port and charge up. But really,
and so what, so in that, the Trump is like the hairy pet that just can't help
the dog
me.
Being chased
hairs
around
all
the room,
over the ground.
No, but what is a red line here in terms of investigation? Because this is what we had in 1998 with Bill Clinton. The red line was his personal life.
Yes, it's a good question, Bill. It's a tough one. You know, Mueller would probably say there is no red line.
Right.
A lot of prosecutors, you know, people who carry out prosecutions for a living, you know, FBI agents and prosecutors, they don't think there should be such a thing as a clear line where they can't go. They just, they always say they go where the evidence leads them. But you could, I think this is unusual. This is a president. You could say one thing could be investigating Trump's financial affairs before he was president or a candidate for office is, you know, the investigation just doesn't fairly cross into there since the jurisdiction was, has there been collusion with the Russians? I think it's arguable that all these accounts of payoffs to alleged mistresses, it's very interesting just legally, that, you know, some people say, oh, well, that's a campaign finance contribution.
You know, John Edwards was prosecuted. You could also make the argument, no, that Whalen or you did this because they didn't want to hurt their family and have that come out. So
there's an even better legal argument, which is, if Trump regularly has girlfriends and pays them off, then it has nothing to do with a campaign. So it can't be a campaign finance contribution. It's just the regular cost of doing business in the Trump organization.
Okay.
So, you know, you could say that, you know, again, the jurisdiction of Mueller's probe is set out as, you know, collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russians.
Right.
So I think you could, I think Trump could fairly say those things are off limits.
Right.
And I think that would be, if the White House had appointed someone who legitimately and constitutionally could hold the Attorney General's position, even in an acting capacity, I think they could say that to Mueller, and I think that would be completely fair and legal. But I the interesting thing, I think, is by making such a mistake, I don't think Whitaker has the political capital and even the constitutional authority now to tell Mueller to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
So in a weird way, by having this blow up, the Trump White House, by being too clever by half, has actually unleashed Mueller. Because Mueller, suppose Whitaker says, you know, don't investigate Trump's finances before 2015.
Mm-hmm.
Mueller could say, you are an unconstitutional officer. I do not have to obey anything you have to say to me.
Exactly.
And Mueller would be right.
Right. Interesting. Let's close out on the topic here. So the man does have interim in front of his name, or acting attorney general, whatever the official title is. Matthew Whitaker, in theory, will not be in this job 6 months, a year from now. Who, John Yoo, would you put in this job? Who would, first of all, want this job necessarily? I assume a lawyer has to have the job.
Has to be a lawyer.
So that rules out Ivanka and Jared, I assume.
Well, you never know. Trump University might have given them a night degree we don't know about.
But you need to fill this job. So if you're the White House, who do you look for? Because you now have this calculation of a Republican Senate that at most will have 52 seats, 51 seats. So you need every Republican on board for confirmation. So what model do you put forward?
So I think you look back to times when there have been similar controversies like the Watergate, times like that. This is a time when Trump, I think, could appoint someone like a former federal judge or a senator. Sitting senator.
Well, I'll give you an example of a former federal prosecutor named Chris Christie. But Chris Christie comes with a lot of baggage, and I don't mean suitcases, but as is being governor of New Jersey. So, again, he's got to find somebody who is qualified and rather pristine.
And can be confirmed.
And
Giuliani
correct.
Has also been mentioned. He turned down the job already 2 years ago.
Right.
Apparently, he wants the job now. But again, I think that's a difficult confirmation. Former federal judge and really a sitting senator right, would have less difficulties with conference, but they also would be, you need someone who has political standing, not just being a good lawyer.
Right.
So, you know, you can say Lindsey Graham.
I was going to say all roads point to Lindsey Graham.
That's what it is.
Who said he doesn't want the job.
They always say that, though.
Right. So now we get into the whole Nikki Haley leading the UN conspiracy thing. So.
Oh, I hadn't heard that one.
When we don't have a controversy, we have a conspiracy in Washington. Let's shift gears, John. Let's talk about your alma mater.
Oh, God.
Fair Harvard. You're Harvard class of 1989, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I went back and I did some research on you, my friend, at Harvard. Under the John Yoo file. John Yoo wrote a lot for the Harvard Crimson.
I did. And for my sins.
Yes, and you wrote a column in 1987, November 1987, John, almost 31 years to the day, actually, in which you talked about the declining number of black and Hispanic candidates at Harvard.
Hmm.
Why didn't you talk about Asians?
You know, it's interesting. We didn't know, and this is one of the great things about this Harvard lawsuit. As a student, and I think even just everybody, did not really know what the Harvard admissions office had been up to.
Can you explain the lawsuit in a nutshell?
Yeah. So the amazing thing is, and it was true when I was a student too, is the Harvard has basically kept a cap on the number of Asian American admissions for years and years, decades, mm-hmm. in fact. But they never had to explain before how they were picking people.
Right.
And so what this lawsuit did is it forced Harvard to disclose its internal documents of how they actually pick people.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems pretty clear that they engage in not just taking race into account when they look at a person and all the different things they had to overcome mm-hmm. or help them succeed. They were, I think, pretty nakedly making racial stereotypes about different racial groups in order to deny or admit people to hit specific racial targets for the composition of their classes. So what Harvard showed is they rank people basically on several factors: academic excellence, extracurriculars, recommendations, athletics, and so on, legacy, where Asians were performing at the top.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's this fifth category called personality. And Asians, even though they score at the top for every category, were ranked at the bottom of the evaluation. And the vast, vast majority of the Asian applicants who were receiving bottom scores in personality mm-hmm. had never been interviewed by any Harvard admissions officer or alumnus.
Really?
Oh, yeah. This is an incredible thing. So there would be these admission file readers at Harvard College who are just looking at applicant files, and they're just ranking almost every Asian applicant at the bottom of the ranking of personality, which must come as a great surprise to, say, the billion people in China. I'm sure some of them have personality.
So there are five categories. So the admissions officers look at five categories, John. One's academic.
Yeah.
Second one is extracurricular. Third one is athletic. The fourth one is personality, personal as they call it. And the fifth one is, quote unquote, overall.
Yeah. Right. And so and this is, unfortunately, we've seen this in other universities too. If everyone's tying, you know, comes to hire, they're very close on the four out of the five categories,
mm-hmm.
then there's a huge variation on the fifth factor.
Right.
Guess which one determines who gets in? The personality factor.
Right.
And so even though Asians are performing well above all other racial groups in test scores, GPAs, extracurriculars, all those different metrics,
mm-hmm.
and there are many, many more Asians applying.
Right.
Somehow they always hit between 18 and 20% of the student body every single year, year after year. I think what's really going on is, and I don't think it has anything to do with whites. I think mm-hmm. what Harvard wants to do is have a certain percentage of Hispanics and African Americans
mm-hmm.
in the Harvard College class. And they're willing to do almost anything to hit those targets.
And the percentage of Asians at Berkeley is, what, about 45%?
Yeah, this is the amazing thing. So when I first started teaching at Berkeley, there was also a very aggressive affirmative action program. And it wasn't until Governor Wilson and sort of colorblind activists got together and got Prop 209 on the ballot and got it passed. And Berkeley, and I was a faculty member at the time, Berkeley had to get rid of affirmative action. And again, just like Harvard, Berkeley had a steady number for Asian applicants year after year after year. And then once affirmative action is done away, that shoots up to 40-some percent.
Exactly.
And even though I think the Berkeley admissions office does everything they can
mm-hmm.
to try to have a different mix of minorities, it could well be if you just use test scores and GPA, the percentage would be like in the 50s or 60s. But still, it's even in the 40s.
Right.
And I don't see why it wouldn't be the case like that at Harvard, too. I think it's also that way at Caltech,
right.
schools that explicitly cannot use consider race in their admissions process. Right. Asian applicants, Asian percentage goes to about 30 to 40 some percent.
So, John, Harvard is a private university, as is Stanford, as are the Ivy League colleges. Why can't a private university just decide we want to have 20% of our student body to be Asian and 15% to be African American slash Latino and 45% Caucasian? What federal and state obligations are they under to not do that?
That's a good question, and in a way, this is the this is the fruits of the liberal project coming back to bite them, because one of the ways that liberals have really extended the reach of the federal government is by attaching conditions to people who take federal money. Mm-hmm. So a lot of what the federal government does is actually attach, you know, if you want to take federal money to, you know, build an interstate highway, then you have to comply with all these obligations. Right. Does it all the time with states. You know, if you take federal funds, for example, health or welfare, you have to run a state welfare program that does this, or education, right? And so on. This is exactly what's going on here. Recipients of federal money cannot discriminate on the basis of race or gender in their operations. So a school could do, as you suggest. There is one school that I know of that does that, called Hillsdale College, a little liberal arts school up in mid-state, up in mid-Michigan, I think.
Yeah, right? Michigan.
And they take no federal funds.
Right.
But I don't think it's a dirty secret, but one of the secrets that also come out as a result of your question and the Harvard litigation is a lot of our major universities receive hundreds of millions of dollars every year from the federal government to underwrite research,
NIH money, defense money, things like that.
And student scholarships, Pell grants and so on. And no major research university could conceive of saying, we're just not going to take federal funds.
Okay. So let me ask you now kind of a quasi-political question to go with the legality of this. Donald Trump spends a lot of time bashing the media. It's interesting, John. I was talking to Neil Ferguson about this yesterday, and that before Tuesday night's election, you had kind of a funny setup in America, in that Democrats had no power in government. Mm-hmm. They did not have the presidency. They did not have control of Congress. They didn't have control of governorships, largely outnumbered in those. State legislatures, state legislators, Democrats are just vastly outnumbered, so no real foothold in government. Now they've got the House back. Mm-hmm. But then you look on the other side, pop culture and non-government, so let's look at entertainment. It's dominated by liberals. Mm-hmm. Let's look at the media. It's basically run by liberals. Let's look at academia, largely run by liberals. Donald Trump spends a lot of his time attacking the media. Why isn't Donald Trump going after academia?
It's an interesting question, because a lot of people in the conservative movement.
This strikes me as a freebie. He could go after Harvard, home of Lawrence Tribe, by the way, a big Trump tormentor, and he could say, you know what, Harvard, I think you're a bunch of racist scumbags. You're not getting money.
Yeah, Bill, I was thinking about this. You know, this is also true of Nixon, too, isn't it? Nixon attacked all, you know, some people say Trump is just taking the Nixon playbook and just updated it for the 21st century. And I always wondered about that, too. And I've read a bunch of biographies of Nixon, and maybe it helps explain Trump. Mm-hmm. Nixon, right, he hated the Ivy League, but when it came time to hiring his staff, right, Henry Kissinger, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, hired all these Harvard and Ivy League professors and advisors. So I think actually did him a good, good
Trump,
turn.
And Trump is stalking a Supreme Court with, surprise, Harvard and Yale judges.
Harvard and Yale graduates, right? And people say, you know, Nixon, he could have, but he strangely respected them. He had a hate relationship with higher education. And I somehow think Trump thinks the same thing. Or Trump's very proud of the fact he went to the University of Pennsylvania and Wharton, right? His kids, you know, Kushner went to Harvard,
right?
I think he has a similar love-hate relationship with higher education.
Right.
But I agree with you. I think
let's take the politics out of it, though. Is there a legitimate can the federal government make a statement here saying that we think you discriminate and we're going to withhold money until you correct the situation?
Well, you know, they've gone halfway there. So the Justice Department, under Jeff Sessions, actually has filed suit joined the Harvard lawsuit to say they agree with the plaintiffs. And yeah, I think that would be the next step. That would take an aggressive move by the president. But it would be interesting politically, because one thing that's always puzzled me, too, is how far over Asians have gone to the Democratic Party.
Right.
And if there's one thing that would be like a thunderbolt, I think, in the Asian American community, is if President Trump said, I'm withholding federal funds to universities that discriminate against Asians on the basis of, you know, their race and university admissions. I think you would see a big swing of Asian Americans to the Republican Party if that happened.
Sean, as recently as 1976, Harvard did not recognize Asians as a minority group. and they actually banned Asians or barred them from a freshman minority orientation banquet. Why was this relationship between Asians at Harvard this way? Why would they not recognize Asians as minorities?
You know, first of all, I hate to say it. I think this is something that Harvard has a long history of doing, not just with Asians, but everybody else.
Is this analogous to Jews?
Exactly.
What did Harvard actually do with Jews at admission? Because I know there is internal bias within the school in terms of Jews getting into social clubs in Harvard, but what about the admission side?
Oh, the president of Harvard University back in the day in the 1920s, and then I think it continued until after World War II, there were explicit restrictions on the number of Jews who could be admitted to Harvard College class because they weren't the right person. I mean, I think there's even a quote from them say they're not the kind of – they're not clubbable. You know, they're not the kind of people who could join the right clubs. And this was not – hidden like the Harvard ones now in admissions office memos. I'm pretty sure the president of Harvard University publicly said this. I've seen the quotes from the day.
How was that rectified?
So eventually after World War II, some people say this was a result of the Holocaust and World War II, the terrible things that happened to the Jewish people. Mm-hmm. Harvard realized this kind of policy, and all the other Ivy League schools did, were untenable. So I think you have the same attitude today, you know, from Harvard leadership. And, we shouldn't just say it's always Harvard. This is widely shared, I think, amongst the top leadership of the top universities. Mm-hmm. You know, Asians don't have the right personality. You know, I'm going to have to give up my hopes to be a stand-up comedian now, I guess, because I'm Asian. Or Asians aren't the right kind of person to join the right kinds, as you say, these social clubs or the right kind of banquets at Harvard College. I think there's still that attitude amongst the university leaders in our country.
So one place where Asians are underrepresented at Harvard, John, is in commencement speakers. I did a little digging over the last 30 years. Stephen Chu is the only Asian American to give a commencement speech at Harvard in the past 30 years.
That's incredible. I'm not surprised. I bet it's also true of honorary degrees.
Possibly. Well, all right, so let's say Harvard wants to adjust the situation. Let's say Harvard wants to change things. Harvard statistics, John, about 40,000 people apply each year, 2,000 get in, 1,600 slots available. What does success look like at Harvard? Does it look like Berkeley? Does it look like 45%?
I agree. I think what Harvard should do is say we're not going to consider race when we look at people's applications. Maybe we'll look at an individual's socioeconomic background, which is basically what Berkeley is doing and other universities are doing.
Right.
Because what I don't think is necessary is to help, upper middle class minority who's got a B-plus average, right? Like, those are not who we need to help. You know, the kid who maybe makes it out of a tough neighborhood or goes to poor public schools and still succeeds, those are kind of people. But I don't think race has to do with that. Maybe culture, where you live, or your economic class. Those are things schools should still look at, I think. So what does success look like? One success is just no longer looking at the race of anybody, regardless of the consequences, regardless how the classes. As you say, Harvard could choose to do a lot of other things. They could just say, we're going to start admitting more rich people. You know, we're going to start admitting more sons and daughters of famous people.
Great.
Actually, they've been doing that too. You know, they have one other interesting tidbit from the Harvard admissions is that they had a special list for applicants of wealthy, famous people. And their chances of getting in are much higher than anybody else's.
Right.
It turns
out. So Harvard has, John, what are called TIPS, which is a cute little phrase. It means an admissions advantage. TIPS include legacies, meaning you're a son or a daughter of a Harvard Radcliffe alum, relatives of a Harvard donor. You are a child of a staff or faculty member, you're a recruited athlete, or you are an ethnic minority. Hmm. So we assume that Asians are part of ethnic minorities now at Harvard, or we don't know?
No, I
assume they're. Is that what part of this lawsuit's going to tell us?
Yeah, but apparently from everything that's come out so far, Asians don't seem to count as an ethnic minority.
Okay. Let's talk about two other groups that are not on the list of TIPS. What about veterans?
Yeah, I think that's incredible. You know, veterans actually should get, I think, some kind of preference.
Mm-hmm. And what about conservatives? You left. So you're at Harvard in the late 1980s. How many conservatives are running around campus? First of all, were you out? Did you come out?
I guess I did. I was a columnist for the Harvard Crimson, and I remember writing a endorsement of George H.W. Bush and then
over
88
presidential. Over to Dukakis, right?
Yeah, over to Dukakis.
Right.
So I think I was the in-house conservative, the token minority. The real token minorities at Harvard are the token conservatives, which is funny because there were more conservative professors back in those days. I doubt there are any more, but you had people like Sam Huntington around.
Harvey Mansfield.
Mansfield. I took political philosophy from him. He's still there. So you had some conservatives, very well-known ones, and actually they attracted a lot of students because, ambitious students wanted to be challenged. Mm-hmm. The sad thing is, I think, not just student admissions, but faculty hiring now, you see a heavy bent to liberals. There's several departments, I think, at Stanford and Berkeley probably have no conservatives at all. And that's doing harm to the education of the students and to the kind of research that we do.
So again, John, if the federal government is giving money to these universities, can the federal government get involved now in the hiring of personnel at universities?
I think that the federal government should respect academic freedom. Mm-hmm. And there's no sort of constitutional command that the federal government has to ensure ideological diversity, what you're suggesting.
Right.
Although, you would think that you can't discriminate either. So just like a university can't discriminate based on race and gender, I think they certainly can't discriminate based on the views that are held by faculty applicants or professors for promotion. And so, I think that's really, I hadn't thought about that, Bill, but I think that's right. If the federal government can say, we're going to cut off federal funds to you because you're discriminating on the basis of race, there's no reason the education department can start an investigation. Mm-hmm. Are universities actually discriminate against people based on the views they hold, mm-hmm. and then threaten their federal funding for that too?
So if I came to you and said, Professor Wu, I have lost my teaching position at Stanford because, mm-hmm. frankly, I'm the only conservative here at Stanford or at Berkeley who is a right of center, and they just took away my funding. And frankly, you and I know what the deal is. They don't like my ideology, so they just ran me out of there. Mm-hmm. What legal grounds do I have for suing?
Oh, I think you could definitely sue.
What grounds?
So you could say as a recipient of federal funds, mm-hmm. the university has violated your free speech rights.
Mm-hmm.
The university considered illegal criteria. Now, the hard thing is going to be to prove it.
Right.
But I think you could facially bring a claim, get into the courtroom at least and try to make out a claim. It's interesting. I think it's very hard for people to do that because if you're a professor or even a applicant to be a professor, mm-hmm. and you bring a lawsuit like that, your career is probably over. No university will probably ever hire you again. And I think a lot of conservatives also, we tend to support institutions, maybe to our harm. But we tend to be more respectful of institutions. The conservatives aren't usually the kind of people. But there are one or two cases like the one you're describing in law. And I don't know what happened. I think the university settled the cases rather than go to court. Yeah.
So your Washington claim to fame, John, is that you wrote the torture memo. Explain the torture memo.
So what happened is in the months after the 9/11 attacks, the CIA, I think a great intelligence coup, mm-hmm. Managed to capture several of the top leaders of al-Qaeda, people like Ramzi Bin al-Shib or people who actually carried out the planning, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, people who actually carried out the planning and execution of the 9/11 attacks. And these guys were relatively impervious to regular questioning.
Right.
And so the CIA wanted to know, what can we do to put pressure on these guys but not violate the federal statute banning torture?
This is waterboarding?
Yeah, so that's waterboarding is the hardest question. So mm-hmm. a lot of other things I think they did. We would never use in the United States questioning, and I don't think we ever should, to question garden variety criminals.
Sleep deprivation, things like that.
6 hours, not letting people sleep except for 6 hours a day, things like this. Mm-hmm. But I think in those circumstances, in the emergency we're in, worried about follow-on attacks, we said, our view was legally, Congress has prohibited torture, but it hasn't prohibited pressure methods short of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so we said, as long as you don't cross the line, it's legally permissible under American law to go ahead. I think waterboarding was the hardest question because I think that's basically right on the line of what's permitted or not. So we allowed it to go forward, and I think people say, "Oh, it didn't do any good. You didn't get any information." I think it did. You know, we went through a period where Al-Qaeda never succeeded again during that period of carrying out another major attack on the United States, even though they tried. And I think if you look at things like the 9/11 Commission report, you'll mm-hmm. see the vast amount of information we got about Al-Qaeda from those interrogations. And I think it had a lot to do with a lot of the success that the United States had in degrading the Al-Qaeda organization to where it was a shell of its former self.
Right. But it becomes known that you were the author of the memo. Do people come after you in restaurants? Do people knock on your door and protest on your lawn for doing this? Do people harass you in public for doing this?
You know, not anymore. But I used to have these Berkeley protesters show up at my house every Sunday for years. But, you know, they're kind of charming in their way. They're all senior citizens. There was one guy who actually would drive one of those motorized carts back and forth in front of my driveway. It's hard to get angry at people who still think the Vietnam War is going on. But I still, I had these sort of regular protesters who would show up at my house all the time for a few years.
Yeah. Right. But if you did this in today's Washington, what would happen to you?
Oh, well, if you look at
you would need around-the-clock protection if you did that.
Yeah, you see
Washington.
Liberals protesting journalists like Tucker Carlson or people like that. Or there was just a report of someone, threatening Kat Timpf, who's
Fox News blogger. Or Kristen Nielsen getting harassed in restaurants.
That's or Ted Cruz. I mean, I think and you see Democratic politicians encouraging liberals to go on the attack of these people. And I think so if you were a Democrat and you don't like the way Trump has changed politics of the presidency, I would think the thing you don't do is go to not just even go that level, but go below that level, because you don't see Republicans encouraging, you don't see Republicans encouraging their voters or supporters to go physically harass Democratic politicians.
Right. So you teach the law and you respect the law and you respect somebody's right to come protest you. But let's talk about sort of legal lines to cross here, John. Mm-hmm. For example, people protest you in Berkeley, and it's kind of amusing. They're outside of your house. They're not threatening your space. Tucker Carlson has a home in Washington, and the reports are that protesters come on his lawn. They knock on his door. They don't kick down the door, but they set the door ajar. This is scary, and to me, this strikes me as crossing a line. So what legal barriers are we going to have to create here in terms of protesting now? Is this going to have to be like at political conventions every 4 years where there's sort of a speaker's corner for protesters?
Yeah, I think that protesters are allowed to protest on public land. You know, they can protest in the street, although they can't impede the free movement of other people.
Right.
I think the minute that they cross under Tucker's lawn, the police can arrest them for trespass. Mm-hmm. And if they won't do it, the problem here is that a lot of people live in cities where some of the city politicians probably tend to agree with these protesters and mm-hmm. are fine if the police don't happen to be around. So then I think Carlson, unfortunately, is going to have to hire private security, I think, and mm-hmm. enforce his property rights. I think it's a terrible thing for our country's politics and discourse where people who want to take public views on things have to surround themselves with armed guards. But I'm afraid that's what's going to happen if the police and city politicians don't perform their legal duty, which is protect the safety of the citizens.
Right.
But I think that's where it's headed.
Right. So the two schools of thought here, John. One is that this is life with Donald Trump, that everything is a dog whistle. Everything on a scale of 1 to 10 gets treated like a 15. Just everybody goes nuts from whatever Trump says and does. Mm-hmm. And it has these offshoots, such as protest. The other school of thought, though, is this is the new normal in society, that we're just a more bitterly divided society than ever before. And even if Trump leaves office, you're still going to have this for the next president.
I hope not. I think these things go in cycles. History seems to go in cycles.
Right.
And so, when I've read about things and there are times in our history where things were like this or worse. So consider the Vietnam War, consider Nixon.
Right.
People thought the same things. Is this a permanent degrading of our political discourse? Are these, crazy anti-Vietnam War hippies going to be the future? And, within just a few years, Reagan becomes president and things get restored. Things not just get restored, they get better, much better.
Right.
I don't know how that happened. I mean, this sort of politics and culture, as you're suggesting. But Reagan repaired the political culture pretty quickly. You're only talking about 6 years between Nixon resigning and sort of that sort of counterculture protest world seeming to take over, and then sort of a restoration of normal values and norms in our society. So I hope that it's just a passing phase and that we're going to, sort of ratchet back to where things ought to be in the country?
It's an awfully good question, because you can say, well, Trump represents really this end of this erosion, which kind of began with the Clinton presidency. It's not to lay this on Bill and Hillary, but when you look at the political system starting to tumble, it begins in the Clinton era and picks up speed in the Bush era and picks up more speed in the Obama era, and now we have Trump. Have you thought about going back to Washington?
I'm not putting up for attorney general. Would kill me. Oh yeah, I'm available for attorney general, but I would be in the same position as Whitaker. I haven't received advice and consent either. Now, I think it's a duty for all of us, if we're called to public service and we can actually help,
right,
that we should do it. You know, it's we don't have the draft anymore, but this is something that's similar. So I think anyone who would have to seriously consider serving under presidents of any party.
How does Judge Yu sound to you?
Well, I know it would drive the Democrats in the Senate insane. Like they would go to – I mean, Kavanaugh would look like a garden party compared to what they tried to do to stop me from getting onto the court.
No, seriously, would you entertain going on the Ninth Circuit?
It would be entertaining, not just for me, but I think it's important, and I think that's something we've lost, actually, in a way, is this idea that people should answer the call for public service that the government wants them to. We tend to think of it all as sort of career advancement now.
Right.
And I think it's actually public service is not necessarily, from my own experience, not necessarily good for your career.
Well, so you hit on something very important here, John. So I could ask you, would you like to run for office in California? And you would look at me like I'm on crack, because you would know you would lose. So why would I why would I go out there and take a beating?
Yeah.
But on the other hand, if I ask you, would you like to be a judge or something which you're very qualified for, you're making the calculation and part of, my God, what would I have to go through to get this position? Mm. And this is bothersome, because think of how many men and women out there are thinking about, maybe I'd like to work for the federal government, I'd like to hold a position, but I don't want to get entangled in the blood sport.
Well, isn't that part of the reason why liberals did what they did with Kavanaugh?
Yes.
They thought it was win-win for them.
Yeah.
Either they stop Kavanaugh. If they don't stop Kavanaugh, they have now created a huge disincentive for most conservatives who may have utterly blameless records and no history of anything untoward, aren't going to want to serve anymore. There are already enough reasons why public service is difficult, and now this. But again, it could be example of what you were saying, Bill, that there's been this just one direct, unidirectional decline in our politics from which we won't recover. Or maybe this is just like, you know politics. The 19th century, in some ways, politics was much worse than it was today, and you sort of recovered from these
People would fire guns at close range.
Jackson. Well, they would beat people on the floor of the floor of the House. And in the late 19th century, the things they would say about candidates in some ways is worse than what they say now.
Right.
So maybe, I mean, but it's not just going to happen automatically, or just we wish it to be so. They're going to have to be people like a Reagan or maybe a Tip O'Neill or someone like that, who come in and are determined to change the political culture in the right direction, at maybe even cost to themselves, when there's the incentives are so just to employ Trump's tactics, because they seem to work for both sides now.
Final question on Trump and judges, John. If you're taking yourself out of the running for the Ninth Circuit, I'll still keep
beating let's be ambitious. Let's make it the Supreme Court, now that Justice Ginsburg has broken some more ribs.
Okay,
she's running out of ribs.
Right. So the president had a bad night in terms of the House, but he will survive in the Senate.
And maybe
even if they only get 51 or 52 seats, he can still confirm judges. Yeah. Tell me what success looks like in 2 years for Trump and judges.
So
he can't fill every federal vacancy out there, but what – just give me kind of an idea of where he should be looking right now. Should he be looking at the Ninth Circuit, or where should he go?
As a conservative, this has been – as a legal conservative, who – I'm not the biggest fan of Trump. This has been the most successful presidential term for the appointment of conservative judges in history, more than George W. Bush, more than Reagan, more than Nixon. It's been incredible.
Right.
But it's interesting, because probably Trump doesn't personally care one little bit about the ideology of the judges picked, but he outsourced it. It is one of, you saw in the primary system, the thing that really allowed him to separate from his competitors was saying, I'm basically going to appoint from lists created by the Federal Society for the appointment, not just of Supreme Court justices, but all the lower court judges too. So every president usually has to compromise or give some seats to somebody else, like a home state senator or friends. Trump is not. I mean, he is appointing the best and brightest in the youngest generation of legal conservatives. It's astounding. And at a rate, I mean, it's the good thing, I think, is Senator McConnell also sees this as a priority.
Right.
And so they are not just appointing really rock-ribbed conservatives, but at an astounding rate, far beyond any previous president in the modern era. So, you know, we shouldn't, you know, what everyone thinks about Trump personally or different areas of policy, conservatives should all be unified in agreement that this has been a great victory for him in terms of policy. So where should he be looking? The thing about the Federalist Society, and I think liberals are, you know, right to worry about the Federalist Society because it's been so effective. Mm-hmm. And I wish there were more of them in every other policy area too. Federalist Society has been creating, as it were, safe space.
You're a member, right?
Yeah, I've been a member since my first week of law school.
Yeah.
A sort of safe space for conservatives to talk and develop their ideas about the law. There is a huge, deep bench of young conservative lawyers out there, you know, age 50 and younger. Mm-hmm. And it's not going to be a problem to find candidates for any of these circuits. You know, and if so, if they Democrats employ Kavanaugh tactics on them, there's going to be five or six more behind them for every seat. So it's not something to even really worry about is where they're going to come from. It's more Trump and McConnell going to maintain the political priority that they've given to judgeships. But there's going to be plenty of people, I think, in many ways, far more than liberals.
Right.
You know, I think President Obama didn't make it a big priority. And so, you know, he appointed some very well-known liberals to the circuit courts. But he also compromised a lot and appointed some relatively boring, you know, you know, lame ones too, for which I'm grateful.
Right.
And but also did it at a very slow pace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I figured out why you don't want to be judge you. You're holding out for justice you.
That's right. President Trump, don't call me unless you've got a vacancy on the Supreme Court ready. And the and you're gearing up for the mother of all confirmation hearings.
Oh, by the way. John, you enjoyed the conversation.
Bill, thanks a lot. Thanks for having
me. And smart move getting out of Berkeley on Saturday. That's big game is not a pretty picture sometimes.
Yeah, and the score is not going to be good either. But as you say, either way I win and either way I lose too.
There you go. There you go. You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes. And if you wouldn't mind, please spread the word. Get your friends to have a listen. The Hoover Institution is online at www.hoover.org. And while you're there, do yourself a favor and sign up for Hoover's Daily Report, which delivers the latest from John Yoo and his Hoover colleagues to your inbox weekdays. The Hoover Institution has Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst. That's @HooverInst. John Yoo is not on Twitter.
No. Never will be.
So where do we find your stuff? You have a piece out on FoxNews.com right now?
And The Atlantic actually is just running a piece.
The Atlantic is running a piece,
Whitaker,
too. So two places to look for John Yoo. Yeah. Or just Google John Yoo.
Oh, no. Don't Google.
There are a lot of John Yoos on Twitter, by the way, who are not John Yoo. So don't go on Twitter, folks. For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Until then, take care. Thanks for listening.
For more podcasts from the Hoover Institution, please visit hoover.org or Hoover's channels on all major podcast platforms, including Apple, Google, Podbean, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Spotify. I'm Chris Dauer for the Hoover Institution. Thanks for listening.